A man of language, landscape, and letters, the late Kenneth Irby filled his early years with travel and experiences that associated him with the Bay Area Renaissance poets, the New American poets of Black Mountain, North Carolina, and the radical language poets of the West Coast. A history major who was influenced by his older brother, James Irby, a Latin American literary translator and Princeton University professor, Kenneth Irby created his own path as a poet. His nearly 20 publications culminated in his book, The Intent On, Collected Poems 1962 to 2006, winner of the Shelley Memorial Award from the Poetry Society of America. It contains not only poems, but some of Irby's five decades of extensive notes and narratives. A few months before his death in July 2015, he shared stories with former Kansas Poet Laureate Denise Lowe, which I recorded at his home in Lawrence, Kansas. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air, and since more of this interview appears in the February 2018 issue of the Writer's Chronicle, we'll listen again to the past American voice of Kenneth Irby, beginning with his 1964 poem that reflects the cultural geography of his home state, written for a friend who was later a colleague there at the University of Kansas.
Set series for Roy Gridley. If you go out of Fort Scott south and then west toward Pawnee Station, you get completely different country than if you leave north and then west, or east, or go on straight south. Incursions of the prairie, Pawnee Station, or north near Hammond toward Kansas City, upon the hills and trees covering, come in from Missouri, or due west, out the country roads behind Gun Park toward the Pasture Airport, is so wild a hill and hedge and rock, like wilderness, condensed intensity. There is no sea near. Witches come out, the anguish dead into the mind to breathe it even. Last year's beer cans thrown away clank against the ones thrown out tonight in the same places always traveled to get there, and all the spirits dead in this place start and surround and wait.
That's the first part of a set series for Roy Gridley by Kenneth Irby from his book of collected poems, The Intent On. We'll hear more about Irby's famous long sets later in this conversation with fellow poet Denise Lowe.
I know you were born in Bowie, Texas. Your family then is from Mississippi and North Carolina, respectively.
Yeah.
And then you moved up to Fort Scott when your dad was a physician at the age of, what, three or four?
Three plus. My brother, he was almost nine by the time we moved there.
Okay. Yeah. And I know your writing is so finely tuned to sound. Did you study music?
Oh, I took piano lessons for a little while with the worst teacher of anything I've ever had in my life, and so I didn't keep up with that. I would like to have. My father played the piano very, very well. And there was a piano in the house. He played it every day when he came back from his practice. We listened to music recordings. There was music all the time. All sorts of music. My father was classically trained, and then when he was, say, about high school age, he started playing jazz and pop music. And so all sorts were present. That I got a great deal out of, still do.
One of the stories you've told that stays with me is your trip to Kansas City where you bought a book of poetry by Rilke.
Yeah, see, Fort Scott is only 90, 100 miles at the most, depending on what part of Kansas City you're going to, south of there. And so it's a very easy day trip. You know, when we first moved to Fort Scott and bought the house that we lived in until years and years later, my father and mother also went up there and bought furniture. Mm. So we started going there when I was still very small. And I was always impressed by Kansas City because, to my eye, and I think I was right, it's a real city, not just a big town. It had skyscrapers. And something my mother often did, and sometimes quite frequently with friends of hers, was to go shopping. There used to be these wonderful old department stores downtown.
I remember.
Don't exist there anymore. And like all good department stores, especially that era, they had book departments as well as every other kind. And I was poking around in, I think it was in Klein's, and found this volume of Rilke's Duino Elegies. Now, I somewhere had seen Rilke's name, but I really didn't know anything about him. I was 14, just started high school. And it looked very intriguing. It was a book that I think had been there since it was published in English about 1938. And I persuaded my mother to get it for me. Not that I understood the poetry, but it turned me on to all sorts of things. There was the translation, was by J.B. Leishman and Stephen Spender. Opposite side was German, which I knew nothing of at the time. There was a Picasso painting illustrated. Wow. There was a long introduction. There was commentary on all these references to people and places and work that I had encountered before. And so it was a turn on. I've still got it. It's a book I wouldn't want to ever be without.
Yeah, you brought it to our group one time and showed it to
us.
It was a relic.
Yeah, and that led me to get other work by him or get my brother to check it out from the KU library. So it's, by that point, Jim was at KU, and he was always a great turn on himself to all sorts of things. And, you know, he was studying Latin American literature mainly, and so I learned about Neruda, Vallejo, people of that sort. One's not so well known, Jose Asuncion Silva, from him. Those stick in my memory.
You did your bachelor's degree at the University of Kansas in history, 1958, and then you went to Harvard?
I got an MA at Harvard, in East Asian Regional Studies. I got drafted. I spent 2 years in Albuquerque, part of that time in the North Pacific, and other on the way there and back spots, and then I went back for a year to work on a PhD. That really wasn't my calling. I was still deeply interested in it all, but I didn't want to make a career out of all that, so I left.
After the Army, then, how did you end up at Berkeley?
Well, I got a job in Albuquerque for a year. I'd already been there in the Army for the better part of 2 years. So I went first to San Francisco, where I had a number of friends, including those I'd met in the Army. Eventually found myself in the East Bay, where I found it more comfortable altogether to live. And I liked Berkeley. I got there in 64, at the beginning of the free speech movement.
Were you writing poetry?
I started writing poetry when I was 13, and I didn't stop.
You know, I'm thinking the collected works. I enjoy the poems that are written from that area. You know, I love all the geography.
Well, the earliest poem there, I think, is the one that's dedicated to Bob Grenier. We had both come back to Harvard from being away for a while. He is an undergraduate, and he is a graduate student. We knew Creeley, we knew a number of people in common, and got to know each other that way.
Yeah.
And he's still a very, very, very good friend.
Well, would you read that?
The Grasslands of North America for Bob Grenier. Only a succession of far-reaching green prairies. The grass that is in my backyard. As we moved down the hill in the grass, looking past the highway toward Hammond, our pants and legs caught thick in it, the same winds blowing. Where Pike entered Kansas, and drunk after drunk in high school, we ended the piss in the clover, the smell of clover. So strong for miles, we stopped the car and got out, drunk in the roadway. That same country has entered the first time it was ever seen. It has entered again and again, each time I come to it, as I came here at 3 out of Texas, was the new world. There must be in the juice and flesh a same plane as these, the same moving wave as this grass. The body comes back to only having heard as they only heard, by hearsay, and believed it.
The Grasslands of North America for Bob Grenier, written in 1962 and published 15 years later in Kenneth Irby's book Catalpa, and then in his collection The Intent On. Robert Grenier, one of the West Coast language poets, was also influenced by Robert Creeley, who taught in the mid-50s at the famous Black Mountain School outside Asheville, North Carolina.
Founded in Rawlins, Florida in 1933. It didn't move to Black Mountain until several years later. A man named Rice was the founder who set it up originally there in Florida and then in North Carolina on the principle that there would be no administration, the faculty would run the school, and that everybody who taught there had to be actively engaged in whatever it was they taught. And during the 30s, it became the haven for a lot of émigré artists fleeing the Nazis or equivalent. So they benefited from that. Josef Albers went on to Yale, was a very famous color theorist, and his wife Annie was one of the great weavers of the 20th century. And you had a lot of people from New York, both as students and people who taught there too. Mm-hmm. I think Jack Torkoff taught. Cage was there as a teacher mm-hmm. for a while.
John Cage.
Flat Mountain was a very small place. You must realize this. I was never there. But reading about it and talking with people about it, there were never very many students yeah. at any one time. That was part of the problem. They kept relying on tuition, and it wasn't enough. In the end, it wasn't even vaguely near enough. And it was a working farm, I gather. They just went under.
You know, Charles Olson, Ed Dorn, Robert Creeley, Robert Duncan.
Rauschenberg, the painter.
Rauschenberg, yeah.
He was a student there. Arthur Penn, the stage and film director, was a student there. I mean, lots and lots yeah. of famous yeah. names. So for its size, it generated a great deal of energy and impact, went way beyond just a small enclave in North Carolina.
I remember a wonderful story about you meeting Robert Creeley. How did you first meet him?
He was at Ed and Helene Dorn's, and they were moving to Pocatello the next day, and he was there with his VW bus to help them move.
Okay.
That was Fiesta time, Santa Fe, September 1961, I think.
These Black Mountain poets have become such icons, at least for the poets I know, that it's hard to imagine them packing up, moving, you know, the grubby essentials of living day to day.
Well, we've all done that, I assume, yeah. one voice or another. Circumstances, perhaps, I don't know that they were any different in that regard than just about any other set of writers I've known. Well, Robert Duncan tended to be more domestic. No, he and Jess, that was part of their conviction, was making a household together. And they did.
Hmm. Well, there's a poem in there for Ed Dorn.
Well, this was the result of a visit back here to Lawrence. I was living in Berkeley and had returned to see various people. We, John Moritz, and I think Ed was certainly there, and Roy and I drove up and made this excursion to the northeast part of the state. Three geographical variations for Ed Dorn. North out of Lawrence, we turned east before we had to a backtrack to Valley Falls and Ozaukee back roads into Hiawatha. Old trips of the past will not save us. Noon meals, in or out of a calendar, picture quiet and readdress the east turn into White Cloud and Iowa Point to reach toward the river and where the river's urge in us eased us a little. That is the flow, the urge toward each other links hand in hand as word in word, driving, drinking beer all Sunday afternoon. I've come west and at the far ocean, remember. It does not matter loose specifics of whose, the linkage matters, the flow, the closeness possible, the intimations of divinity as intimations of the dreamed spread land spread before the eyes of those white cloud diddled sooners, even the willful, wily promoters looking west at the land's run out from under them. I will not let blood, and I do not know if there's any turning back upon the land to traverse, how much traversing now will reopen, what spaces seem nowhere ease us together. It is not different to go past the endless misuse of landscape here in Berkeley or there in New Mexico. What space is open beyond is open across the whole world, looks past whatever salvations of individuals, realizing salvation is only to pass into the space all people live in. There is no need to substitute any world for this one in order to come into any wonder or more enter the open imagination. Good and evil seem kindness and indifference at each footstep. At the other edge of each tree, another pasture, the shade fallen on each face into the sun, into each lit house, dark street we walk home, the stories where we are all changed beyond the wardrobe's back wall, pass through the eye is blue wonder, brown opener, the horizon shines through upon the toss and fling, the ring glints, head up in the air, grass goes by like starlings, iridescent in the sky.
The late Kenneth Irby reading for New Letters on the Air. That was three geographical variations for Ed Dorn, originally published in the book Relation and in his later collection, The Intent On, which also contains an elegiac set for Ed Dorn, written after his death in 1999. Dorn, a student at Black Mountain in the early 50s, taught at various universities, including the University of Kansas in 1968, though Irby was then living in California. Denise Lowe shares a site where Irby's timeline can be traced.
Jacket 2, an online zine, has put up that marvelous collection of essays, some letters from you, some poems, a whole trove of Ken Irby lore and insights and reflections, including Lynn Hagenian and many others, Pierre Shores and so forth. I was looking at the letter describing your visit with Carl Sauer.
It wasn't a letter exactly. It's just something I wrote down afterwards so that I would remember what had happened. Bob Callahan, who was a very dear friend, was Carl Sauer's literary executor, and he knew I cared a lot for his work, and so he took me to meet him. Sauer was in the hospital recovering from a gallbladder operation, and so we were just there in the hospital room with him, not for very long, and talked a little, and then when I went back to wherever I was staying, I wrote it down. Same thing with the visit of Malin. It was just to help my recollection of it. But I didn't send them. I think Bob Callahan, that is, printed them in the magazine, the journal he and Eileen Callahan put out called New World Journal.
And he was at Black Mountain also?
No. Carl Sauer was from eastern Missouri. He did his graduate work at Michigan. He was the chair of the Michigan Geography Department when he went to Berkeley in 1923. That's where he stayed the rest of his career.
Okay.
Until he retired. Charles Olson was very fond of his work. And told people to read him, and that's how I began to hear about him, through Creeley, I think, and Dorn, and he was so wonderful. One of the great presences of geography in America in the 20th century, without any question, or any place else, for that matter.
Yeah, indeed, and I think that Barney Worf in our group is telling us about his stature is growing
for
the cultural geographers.
Certainly worth thinking about.
Well, the first time I read your work was when I found a copy of To Max Douglas and read that, and you know, was weeping by the time I was halfway through it. And there's a real emotional impact for your work in addition to a synthesis of the geography, the cultural. And I wondered if you'd read the first two pages of that.
I should say something about who this man is.
Sure.
Who was Max? He came from St. Joe, Missouri, and was a student as an undergraduate here. I heard about him from John Moritz, and I heard about him from Ed Dorn. He was a student at Dorn's. And I saw work of his published in, I guess, primarily in Clayton Eshelman's Caterpillar magazine, and I liked it. You could see there were certain obvious influences of Dorn and Creeley, but he had his own voice. And he came out to California one summer, I guess it was toward the end of the summer, and he was at David Bromage and his then-wife, Cheryl Jaffe, were getting ready to move to Sonoma County, and he was going to help them. He'd been visiting other people he knew in L.A. So there was an evening when we all sat around and talked, and well, then this tells us what happened. He died, I guess he was 21, just barely, of overdose of heroin. But then when I found out about his, particularly since he was so young, demise, I realized that the conversation we had begun that evening, there wasn't any place for it to happen anymore. And so the poem came about as a means of trying to deal with that. And my own shared concerns. We hiked the long, late Sunday afternoon, the Bloomfield Downs of South Sonoma. David said, "Did you know? Max Douglas is dead of an overdose." "I was just about to ask you about him. Anyway," I said, that was right there so far away and lame. We stopped to get across a fence and coax the dog through under. West in one gap of remembrance, the sea was completely shining. Under the coming clouds, we cut up an uncut pasture triangle. Must be, I said, unclaimed. Headed for the highest point. So young, so unwanted, thought. So unknown to himself, what's happening at home? The downs of Kansas will be the Flint Hills, but that northeast corner facing St. Joe across the Missouri is hummocked, bold hills like these, but of a glaciation high separate from the plains. The secret of relief leads to the river there. Where I grew up southeast, it was creek beds, marmot and mud, that is, catfish, gar, not transportation. We both, Max, face out to reach the Great Plains in the back of the head. Your high golden head, the apple Roman beauty of your parents' single eye upon. Queen, king, better, petit prince, uncertain. There would be a needle for that, certainly. Who knows what virginities were lost every time you met another person? Shyness, as McAlmon said of Pound, and of himself, is high vanity, but the spurt to raise that column of gold sand in the spring bed. Some people can make it without drugs, you said, Ed told you, but I can't. Where that leads...
That's the first poem of a long set called To Max Douglas by the late Kenneth Irby, included in his book, The Intent On. Again, here's fellow poet and KU graduate, Dr. Denise Lowe.
You wrote describing the design of one of your long poems, The Kansas, New Mexico, as the designs of a poem are spokes of a wheel, the center hub of which is never given, only implied. I seized upon it because, you know, to me, there are all of these spokes, they're all suspended, but then there's some intangible at the center, there is something beyond the rational. And I guess I connect that with the transcendence, the moment where a poem lifts out of the language and becomes experience.
Well, if a poem or piece of prose, story, novel, whatever, only deals with what you intended to write in the first place, it's deadly dull and of no interest. It takes you nowhere that you didn't already know you were. So the work is, you start with whatever sets you off. Where do you go? And you don't know where you're going to go. At least I don't.
Well, that's the excitement of it.
That's what Dorn taught me from D.H. Lawrence, from his sense of what Lawrence is arguing in that opening chapter of Studies in Classic American Literature, still one of the most seminal of books about American literature, on the spirit of place. Art is what is there beyond what you intended.
I know all the publishers you've worked with, all the printers, have had to learn ways to actualize the long lines.
Well, that's a problem with anyone. If you wanted to deal with Whitman's long line, you've got to... He was a printer himself. He knew what was involved in that. And sometimes the page come across paper that's bigger format than others. Otherwise, you simply do what Whitman did, break the line, indent it, until you get the whole long one, like a verse paragraph.
Mm-hmm. Or like in a set, you just turn the book sideways and it goes...
Well, that was one way of trying to make it less cramped on the page. Part of what one does is exploring it. John Ward's had this batch of paper. That's when he worked for David Longhurst, a printer downtown, which was 14 by 17, something like that, the paper was. And he said, let's see if we can use that for something that would fit, you know. And so the set came out of that, and each portion of that was printed on a separate big sheet like a broadside and then set in a folder. So it's a striking production, although it's not meant for casual use all the time.
It's hard to excerpt your poems because they have such a broad arc in their design from start to finish, from typography and graphics to content. And it's great to hear these snippets, but then it makes me want to go back and read all 600 pages from start to finish.
Oh, dear. Well, there is a lot here, certainly. If it had not been for Kyle Waugh and Cyrus Console, this could never have come about as it did. I mean, not to in any regard diminish Richard Grossinger, the publisher, who called me up one day and said, do you want to do a collected poems? And I said, sure, I guess. But without Kyle and Cyrus, the text couldn't have come together as it did. And that was work that they did in the midst of their own graduate student demands and TA demands on top of them the whole time, too.
Well, I know that they, like many of your students, are dedicated and...
Well, they're very good friends, most of all. And then there were these other good friends who provided, like Thorpe Fite, who is a painter I've known many years in Massachusetts and Ipswich, who allowed us to use this reproduction of his painting, and a photograph by Rob Amory, also a Massachusetts very good friend.
Well, it's always a pleasure. You know, I've looked up to you for decades and tried to learn.
It's always a pleasure to have you here, Denise.
One more poem, and then we'll leave you in peace. Page 524, Some High New Tangerine. That's so beautiful, and the word tierce, I assume, is your own.
Well, it's what Redbird's song sounded like.
Yeah.
It's their time of year again. You know, they're here all winter, but they don't sing until spring comes again. Some high new tangerine wax fancy or pink fluorescent twin of deep lament, of children's coloring book on through a lifetime yet. Bright warm clothes that are a rug to the Empyrean, elytron open through the solid trunk of driven sheet, wrapped close and then passed on. There could not be without that fancy now, that indirection of embellishment, to be most dignity and testament. Crows, take the over to teach us insufficiency. Heart wrap skin to call exultant austerity, and spring open a red bird drop cut. Tierce.
The late Kenneth Irby, reading from The Intent On, Collected Poems 1962 to 2006. It was published by North Atlantic Books and won the 2010 Shelley Memorial Award from the Poetry Society of America. The late poet talked with former Kansas Poet Laureate Denise Lowe at his Lawrence home in March 2015, where I recorded them just a few months before he died at age 78. His extensive collection of papers, letters, journals, and more about our poetry world were acquired by the KU Library in 2017. And now more of this interview appears in the February 2018 issue of the Writer's Chronicle. For links, visit newletters.org. Today's show was produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, with Elizabeth Albano, Sean Weir, Abby Jamison, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.